and shortly after that they looked into a room that was quite empty, except for one big wardrobe, the sort that has a looking glass in the door. There was nothing else in the room at all except a dead blue bottle on the windowsill. "Nothing there," said Peter, and they all trooped out again, all except Lucy.
I took another stab at watching BBC Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe a couple hours ago. She just met Tumnus, and that's about where I nodded off. You would think that even if it's not great, it's still an adaptation of a book I love, and there's still that interest in it. It just doesn't have that kind of... And I don't know what the word is. It just doesn't pull me in nearly the same way the book does at the beginning.
Lewis is just fun to listen to. Mm-hmm. He just has a little... His personality just comes through. This is in the chapter The Spell Begins to Break. "It's all right," he was shouting. "Come out, Mrs. Beaver. Come out, sons and daughters of Adam. It's all right. It isn't her." This was bad grammar, of course, but that is how beavers talk when they are excited. I mean, in Narnia. In our world, they usually don't talk at all.
Right.
I mean, there's just things like that. I mean, they just come out of nowhere. You're reading, you go, what?
You have no idea they're coming. It's just sort of taken for granted. And
but it's just, I think that's just the personality of the writing style.
It's so important to kind of setting the tone for the series that this is someone that we're next to a fireplace or someone, and someone is telling us this story. Even just the opening few scenes where they're exploring the house, I think that's an important tone setter for the series, because it's sort of a wish fulfillment scene for me. I feel like a lot of people have just had that experience of it's a rainy afternoon and you're just stuck at home, and somehow your house just becomes, when you're a kid, just becomes this place of mystery and possibility when the lights are down and it's raining and anything could be around the next corner. And the way Lewis sets it up, where he's got all the different strange objects in the house, like the suit of armor. When you're a kid and you're exploring it, you're almost half expecting you could find some magical world or something. And to me, the book starts off where that actually does happen. Like, the thing that I always felt like could happen, it actually does happen in this one. So I think just right off the bat, it's not that the beginning has, I'm not sure if I would say energy. It just, in fact, in general, I find the beginning of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it's not the strongest opening in the series. Not even as strong as, say, Prince Caspian, with the first scene of them getting yanked off that platform. It's just kind of, okay, there were four children, their names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy, and it's just kind of, in a very kind of almost mechanical way, Lewis is just telling you, and this is who they were, and this is what happened, and then they were exploring, and then Lucy steps through that wardrobe, and it's just, whoa! So I think what pulls me in with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is, it's something that's so identifiable.
It's written for children, you can see that, but it's also told with a, I'm going to tell you a story of something that happened.
Yeah.
It's just that kind of, it's like, okay, I'm going to tell you children a story about something that happened a long time ago, and it's like he's taking something real, and then, okay, I'm going to write it in such a way that children would enjoy the story. So it's like it exists outside of just the pages. I think that's part of why I kind of enjoyed it. And I didn't even understand, I mean, it was years before I really understood, because it took a while for my dad to read through them. I don't know how old I was. But, you know, he started in publication order. So we started with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Of course. We've had this discussion before. But we started in publication order. He's read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and after we'd read The Silver Chair and The Horse and His Boy, and then he said, there's another book that was written, it takes place before The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and it's about how Narnia came to be. And I thought to myself, this has got to be a really old manuscript if it's that old. So I had this image in my mind of my dad pulling out this really dusty old tome from a top bookshelf. And then, of course, he pulled out a book that looked just like the others. And I thought, no, this is strange. But I think that there's an authenticity to Narnia just in how people think. You know, people are puzzled at things that I'd be puzzled by. And even just Lucy, to an extent, there's sort of a, like, the first thought, this must be a really big wardrobe. It's just something you just kind of see yourself thinking.
I think that sense of excitement and possibility you felt, and of course the lamppost is probably the most iconic image in the whole series. I mean, it's just a really interesting image that immediately suggests backstory, and I think just subconsciously gives the world a sense of depth and history to it. I'm like, why is there a lamppost in the middle of a wood? And that's just such a really cool image. And then we have, I guess, the image that really inspired the writing of the whole series, which is a faun carrying an umbrella and parcels in a snowy wood. It was an image that Lewis got in his head when he was 16, that, and then he had to kind of find a backstory for it.
There's an element of, I can say, surrealness to it. It doesn't seem everyday. But just because it doesn't seem everyday doesn't mean it doesn't seem real to an extent. You know?
Yeah.
Because just the way that people act, the way that they behave, the way the, I mean, the fun thing, yeah, the way the siblings behave.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just sort of...
I think even the way Tumnus behaves when he meets Lucy, I love.
Yeah.
I love how it's sort of spooky, I think, when Lucy steps into that wardrobe. And I think it's really kind of eerie and really kind of creepy. Like, imagine, like, finding this in the back in your home or in this house in the back of your wardrobe, this whole other world, and it's snowing and it's nighttime, and then all of a sudden this mysterious creature. That'd be really scary. But instead, what we find is that the mysterious creature, Tumnus, is rather frightened by Lucy, and he's the one saying, like, what are you doing here? Are you what they call a girl? And you would think, like, Lucy would. I think the movie really captured this with the line when Lucy says, "Were you hiding from me?" The subtext being like, "I'm supposed to. I should be the one hiding from you, right?"
Yeah.
And I love that irony, which Lewis is going to continue in Prince Caspian, which once again the children are the myths being discovered.
I mean, there's so many little things here that are just subtle, and it's not even. It's not like Lewis is saying, "Okay, watch this really important point I'm going to make. I'm going to talk here in this story about how wouldn't it be interesting if creatures were more afraid of us than we are." It's just there.
It's taken for granted.
It's just kind of matter of fact. I know the book very well. I can't quote it verbatim, but I can go through a lot of the discussions and I could call out, feels like, at least half the lines verbatim, you know, just in dialogue scenes. And at the same time, there's just enough there that's just continually refreshing. And that's saying a lot, because frankly, I know the line, "What's in the Wardrobe," better than any of the other books. It's almost the method now that entertains me to an extent. I mean, obviously the story and the characters, but there's just those extra little things that I discover as I go through it again.
A lot of people have this experience with Narnia where they read it when they were little. There's a lot of details about the plot they've forgotten and a lot of specifics they've forgotten, but there's a lot of images that really stick with them. I think the lamppost and the faun is one that everyone can kind of relate to. What would you say for you, or maybe just for people in general, what do you think are like what are the images of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe that are sort of like the poster shots that everyone remembers from that book, even if they forget everything else?
I think that the Lucy and Tumnus image is so iconic. I think when people think of the series, that comes to mind, not just for Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And then I think also the thoughts of winter, Christmas, and spring.
Mm-hmm.
You remember, oh yeah, and then there's the winter and it's not, and the children come and there's a lion and it's no longer, and Christmas comes and it's no longer winter anymore. I think just that, just the feelings of and thoughts of the iciness and then the spring and the flowers, I think that's kind of what would stick with people just as they think of the story.
I totally agree. I think certainly that the scene where the snow is melting, that's one of the most memorable scenes in the whole series just because of the way it's written. And it's disappointing in the Walden movie to see that's only like 3 seconds.
The extended version did make a difference. That's something with the extended version. It was.
Yeah, but it's still like, I don't think you'll be needing those coats anymore. Cut, the snow's gone. Whereas I really wanted to see it melt and see the birds slowly come out and the green slowly starts appearing. And so I feel like they kind of missed that. But yeah, it's a very important image from the book. Obviously, the lamppost and the faun. I feel like if you were going to. If you had to depict one scene, like if you're going to pick a cover for the one volume edition of Chronicles of Narnia and you had to have one specific scene, you'd choose that scene because obviously it's the first time in the series for reading in a publication order that we get in Narnia and meet a strange creature or whatever. So that's really important. It's just such an evocative image. It just suggests backstory to you.
And it kind of has to be. And even I think that people realize that even just looking at the Pauline Baynes illustration of Tumnus and Lucy, and how it was definitely copied in the film.
You think it was definitely copied? I'm not sure. There's, I mean, certainly in the design of Tumnus, there's a huge Pauline Baynes influence in the design of Tumnus. I'm not sure.
I think that one shot of them walking away, when I think of this, I don't know. I just think that was kind of copied here.
It could have been. I mean, if you look at it, you realize it's not really the same. First off, I think they're on opposite sides. They are in the illustration, and the lamppost is in the shot, unlike the Baynes illustration. And it's not like they're perfectly walking straight away from camera. It is for like three frames. They're kind of, you know, have their backs to it, but then they quickly change. So I'm not sure if that was intentional or not. I think another scene is the courtyard of statues. And there's something about being turned into stone that, to my mind, just seemed worse than being killed somehow, because it's just such a powerful image.
Yeah. You know, Edmund's with the witch when he's thinking about, you know, time just taking over and their nose is crumbling away and the deterioration. You think, oh, man. And he actually makes it sound more, like you said, almost worse than death there.
Oh, you know something that I really think sticks with people, maybe Americans in particular, is the Turkish Delight scene. Because, I mean, I don't know about you, but when I first read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, I didn't know what Turkish Delight was. Did you know what it was?
No. When I first read it, I learned at a young age because my parents or my grandparents traveled a lot, and they brought some back actually from Turkey, I think. And so I learned at a young age that it was real and what it was. I guess I kind of assumed it was real, though.
Yeah, I mean, I think I always thought it was. I always thought it was real, but I think when I was little and read the book, I imagined it as warm bits of turkey, and I assumed it must be really, really good warm bits of turkey. And then eventually I learned it was it's basically some kind of candy. And when I tried Turkish Delight for the first time, I didn't like it one bit. So I think
was it good Turkish Delight?
Honestly, when I read it today, I still kind of imagine it as warm bits of turkey because that
was
seems,
it good Turkish Delight?
It probably was.
You tried. What did you try?
I don't know, just some stuff I ordered. I just wanted to try Turkish Delight.
Because there's some you can find it in shopping mart aisles, and Willy Wonka has a bit of Turkish Delight.
I tried
it's
that.
It's really horrible
and
stuff.
It tasted like it was like
good.
You know how a vacuum smells when it's got something rubber caught in it. It tasted like that, covered
here's
in sugar.
Here's what you do: find a World Market and find some Turkish Delight, and it probably won't be the labels. If the labels are not written in English, then it's probably going to be some decent Turkish Delight.
I don't know, really, and I just think I've got this image in my head of, oh, the most wonderful warm turkey the world has ever known, and I it's hard to imagine how a great Turkish Delight is. It could be better than that. It's an interesting kind of a balancing act going on in that scene where Lewis has he wants us, the readers, to know that, I think he definitely does, he wants us to know that the White Witch is evil. But he doesn't want Edmund to look like a complete idiot. And I almost wonder if maybe that's one of the reasons he came up with the Enchanted Turkish Delight.
When I think about just the characters in the story, I think Edmund is certainly the most fleshed out.
Well, I mean, he has the most kind of clear arc in the story, I guess. You can pinpoint
the
parts of his arc.
I think just get inside his head a little more. That's part of what surprised me, because, of course, Peter's always been my favorite character. And we see a good bit of Peter. We get a lot of Peter in Prince Caspian. We get a lot of development there. But I think what's kind of interesting is how, in some ways, if you're comparing and contrast this to other books, I think one thing I've always known is Lewis was a very concise writer, and the little things mean a lot.
Uh-huh.
It's not like but there's not a ton of words there.
He paints a picture with a lot of depth with very few strokes.
He really does. And it's, you know, whether it's like, if I were to think about just Peter's character arc or his, just what reveals what goes on in his head, what reveals, you know, his character and personality. You know, the first thing that comes to my mind is him telling Aslan, "I think that, you know, I was too hard on him.
Fault.
I think that was why he helped to go what helped him go wrong," and then Aslan not denying that, but not rebuking him either. Mm-hmm. And then I think of this little gestures, whether it's like Lucy, trying to help Mr. Thomas stop crying, or her giving him her handkerchief, or even just her spunkiness, where, you know, he's been telling her that, I mean, she's in another world. He's crying, and she says, "You should be ashamed of yourself." I mean, just little things like that. It's just
the nicest fawn I've ever met.
I finish the book again, and I look back, and I think, there's really not a ton there. It's hard to really put my finger down why certain things stick with me, or why even the characters stick with me like they do. And I think that just, like you said, painting a picture with very few brush strokes is part of it.
Well, I certainly think, like I was talking about before, the beginning where Lucy just finds the wardrobe, that's just something I immediately relate to and I immediately identify with so much that even though, yes, it's not, Lewis isn't giving us a whole lot of detail here, I just sort of believe that that's real. Because I feel like I've had instances as a kid where that almost happened for real. And, here it just happened. Okay, so it's just something I immediately identify with, and that makes them automatically feel real. I can see what you're saying about Edmund, where you really get inside his head in a much more clearly defined way, at least, than the other characters. And I often wonder if that's the reason, like I was just watching a bit of I was thinking about the BBC versions and also focus on the family radio dramas The Walden version. All three of those adaptations don't have the idea of enchanted Turkish delight in them. In the BBC version, there's kind of, I think, this kind of a knowing glance between the witch and the dwarf, but that's kind of the most you get.
Right.
And I think part of that is, first off, the way Lewis conveys that information in the book is he just pulls you aside as a narrator and says, "Hey, the Turkish delight's enchanted." And, well, what's the film equivalent of that? You know, that'd be hard to do. You can't just have somebody walk on screen and say, "This Turkish delight is enchanted." So part of it is conveying information.
You could if it was The Emperor's New Groove, but sorry.
but another part of it is that I think because you get inside Edmund's head so much in the book. Probably the most obvious example is when he's walking to the witch's castle.
Sure, absolutely.
And he's thinking about, "Oh, I'm going to build sensible roads, and I'm going to pay Peter back, and my own private cinema." You know, all these things. You so clearly get the idea that yes, even though Edmund is being influenced by the Turkish delight, he's still making a choice. And you could pick this apart and make it go either way, but when I'm reading the book, I just don't get the sense that, oh, Edmund was drugged, or Edmund was put under some magical spell, and he couldn't help himself. He made a choice.
And, yeah, I would never say he could not help himself. I would say that, you know, the Turkish delight was part of what, you know, I would say, for instance, maybe he would have turned back and not been so miserable, even though he was miserable in the snow. I think, yeah, he made a choice and he was responsible. You don't ever get the feeling that, well, if it had been Peter or Susan who had come through, they would have done the exact same thing.
Yeah,
I don't
exactly.
think that that's the
and,
case
and I,
at all.
I think that in these adaptations, one of the concerns they have, since we can't hear the character's thoughts to nearly the same extent in a radio drama or a film, is that it's going to seem like, oh, he's just put under a magical spell. This isn't really a choice he's making.
Yeah,
and so I think that's probably the reason why the Enchanted Turkish Delight is usually taken out. But that's just one of, again, that's probably another little thing from the book I remember. You know, the Enchanted Turkish Delight. If you eat it, you want more and more of it.
Rooms full of Turkish Delight. That's a picture I always remember as a kid. I knew what I've had the same image since I was a little kid of what rooms of Turkish Delight would look like.
It's too bad that in like the movie or something, they never got to like show Edmund's head what he's imagining. Get to actually see, imagine just like walking into the White Witch's little ice castle in the movie, and there's rooms of Turkish delight. What that would look like?
Because there are certain things you might know about the story. Like we all know there was a battle at Bruna where Edmund was fighting, Peter was fighting.
All three pages of it.
Were fighting. So there's no things you know happened that you can picture in your mind that aren't described. Yeah, you know, that was something that kind of stuck out to me as, you know, I almost wish I'd seen more, although I know why the emphasis isn't there in the book. What kind of things kind of took you by surprise, almost as like things you've forgotten or things that you thought, oh, I remembered something that wasn't there? Was there anything like that when you're going through it again?
I would probably say the beginning parts of the book again, because they just seem like real people so much that I forget how quickly Lewis just sort of dove into it and didn't spend a lot of time developing the characters at the beginning. And whenever I read, I'm surprised, wow, like Lucy finds the wardrobe on like page 4, you know, and I always, wow, I imagine there being so much more before that. And I remember getting to know these characters so much more. And I just think when you're done with the book, you really feel like you've experienced something with them, even though there's not a lot of time strictly devoted to character development.
Even like the professor, that's something that always kind of gets me. Maybe because I did watch the BBC Narnia movies at a young age. I was around 8, maybe 9, when I saw the BBC Narnia movies for the first time. And I just which of course starts to flesh out the professor immediately in those, and here the first time you actually get any idea of his personality really is the discussion he has with Lucy, sorry, Susan and Peter. And so I think that was something that kind of surprised me, where yeah, he just kind of dives right in, and it's sort of the here and now is most important, and almost more with this one book than with the others. In some ways, I sometimes feel like The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe is almost the most unique out of all of the books. Maybe because it could stand alone the best. I mean, maybe that's it. I don't know.
Well, I think I'll tell you. I think The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe has the least amount going on in terms of story, and also just in terms of themes and layers.
There's something with character development.
I think it's a really good setup for the series. We're set, I think the fact that Lucy get like we've been talking about, Lucy gets to the wardrobe and finds that Tumnus is the one that finds her strange. So that idea of who's really the myth here being kind of blurred and reversed. That's an important idea of the myth becoming fact. That's an important theme to the series. The way that it's we're just being introduced to Aslan slowly, which is probably one of the most important parts of the entire book. Certainly, the second act is the way that we meet Aslan. And Lewis writes, none of the children knew who Aslan was any more than you do, and how that sense of mystery, the sense of who is this guy, we're just slowly learning about him. We get to the Beaver's dinner conversation. Okay, we find out he's a lion. He's not safe, but he's good, and he's the king. We've been waiting for him. We're slowly getting more details about him, and then Edmund says the name of Aslan, and the White Witch completely freaks out, and Christmas returns, which is credited to Aslan in the books. And the snow starts melting. What a huge demonstration of Aslan's power. And we never even met him before. So by the time we actually meet Aslan, Lewis has been spending a lot of time and effort slowly, slowly giving us hints about who he is. So I think one of the reasons that Wardrobe, it feels a lot more simple, and why there's not as much to Wardrobe, is that it works really well as an introduction for a lot of things. Here's Narnia, here's kind of the rules, here's Aslan, here's who he is.
And especially just the fact that he doesn't start off with Aslan is a lion, and therefore he doesn't just go into that. And it's really interesting. I can kind of sympathize with people who might say, "Yeah, I'd like to just be hypnotized and just have my mind erased and then just jot down my initial thoughts upon reading a book like this." Because you wonder, when would you figure out that something is a lion? It might be kind of predictable. Ah, well, we've met the witch. We've already gone through a wardrobe. Aslan must be the lion. But it's just interesting to think about. He doesn't necessarily set it up that way. And also, I don't know when he came up with the title, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. My guess is that he didn't have that title when he wrote these chapters. So I do like how it's that very it's a very intentional revealing, and at the same time, it's hard to do that without setting yourself up for disappointment, setting your readers up for disappointment,
And I think that somehow I think he lives up to the way, mostly because even when they meet Aslan, it's not like, oh, that's it, this is who he is. I feel like Aslan still doesn't say a whole lot, and we're still not quite sure what to make of him for much of the book. And we're even still like, that after the witch talks to Aslan about the deep magic, and then we're still kind of looking at Aslan like, why does he feel so sad? And we still don't quite understand what's going on inside his head. So there's still a sense of mystery about Aslan even when we meet him.
And there's some things he never explores. He never explores the Emperor Beyond the Sea.
Yeah, that's
You
interesting.
never get the idea that the Emperor Beyond the Sea is a lion. That's never there. He sees the son of the Emperor Beyond the Sea.
Yeah, that's interesting. And that's probably something that he was writing Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe as a one-off. And that was something he never thought he'd have to develop. He just kind of had it in there to give Aslan a little more depth. And one more thing he said, oh, I don't have to explain it. It's just to give, feel like Aslan has a history. Another thing I was thinking that's like that is the Robin. The Robin is a clearly the Robin that leads them to to Mr. Beaver, clearly seems to have an intelligence, maybe a human level of intelligence. But can the Robin talk? I suppose we have to assume the Robin could talk, but doesn't. And I just wonder if I can't think of any other examples in the series. Except maybe for the cat and horse and his boy, but then we know that was Aslan. He didn't want to be known.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
I can't think of another example in the series of an animal that's clearly smart but not a talking animal. And maybe I guess the Robin could have been a talking animal, But I wonder if that's something that Lewis would not have done. If he knew he was setting up an entire series, maybe he wouldn't have had the Robin in there quite like that.
I don't know. I almost wonder if he would just say, you know what, this is something that's entirely plausible, and it's entirely consistent within the story, and I don't have to explain it if I don't want to. That would just be, I could see that kind of being his attitude.
Why do you think, I was thinking about this today, why do you think Lewis has the Robin in there? And it's funny, like, because I think BBC cut him out completely. That could be a budgetary thing. Maybe I should be glad they didn't have a guy in a Robin costume jumping around. And I think, the Focus on the Family cut out the Robin completely. And in Walden, the White Robin has a cameo. It's just there for fans. You can probably, it's one of those things where, like, they didn't really use the Robin. They just sort of threw him in there.
It does pissed, though. Does it pssst?
In the movie, yes. The movie just
okay,
goes,
okay, it does.
Did that bird, that's probably one of the weirdest lines I've ever heard in the movie. Did that bird just pssst us? It wasn't until, like, the third time I saw that I actually knew what she was saying. But it's like all the Robin does is lead them to Mr. Beaver, who then leads them to dinner and tells them everything. I think that what Lewis is doing there is rather than – I think he wants to slowly introduce the idea of talking animals rather than just have Mr. Beaver plop up and, oh, he's talking. I think it's the fact that the Robin can't talk makes him more mysterious. Like Edmund says, we don't know if we can trust this guy. I think that Lewis uses the Robin to create a sense of mystery and uncertainty about who can we trust and where is he leading us? Is he leading us into a trap? Oh, he's going and here's this beaver. Is the beaver good or bad? And so I think the Robin is very effective to that end.
Yeah, I think it could be all that. I think part of it is even just, and maybe I just don't think as deeply as you on this. I think that.
What I'm getting at is that it seems like the Robin's unnecessary from a story point of view. Why not just have Mr. Beaver find them immediately?
I kind of think that Lewis just has this idea. I think that I think with a mind like his, I think that he really had to write 7 books to begin to satisfy himself on telling people how this world works.
Uh huh.
And I think that he just thought of, there's some things about how this world works where people will see how it works, like with the talking beavers, and they'll hear, they really get the full picture of it. Hey, oh, the animals are the people here. Who predicted that? And they'll see that and they'll hear it and they say, oh, okay. And then there's other things they might see. Like a bird, trying to get their attention and then leading them somewhere where they might not really understand what was going on. And then there's going to be other cases where they might hear about some things, like hear about the trees being spies,
I love that.
They might hear about that, but then they'll never actually see it take place.
There are the trees. They're always listening. Oh, that idea. It creeps me out so
much. Yeah, but we don't actually – so there's some things that we see demonstrated, like the bird, but we don't hear any explanation. Then there's other things we get explanations for, but we don't actually see it in action until, like Prince Caspian.
Yeah.
And so I think you just have this little mix of different things where it's sort of like, hey, this is how Narnia works. It has its own world. It has its own rules. Its own ways that just life goes on, and you're going to see some of it, you're going to hear some of it, you're not going to get the full picture all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something that's kind of like that.
I love the dialogue where they're walking, and Edmund's like, can we really trust this guy? And Peter's all, well, aren't Robins good in most stories? Because Peter's read the right kind of books, I guess, unlike Eustace. And then I just think it's such a great setup when the Robin flies away and apparently abandons them. And then when the beaver appears, I just find that to be a slightly scary scene because we know nothing about who this is going to be. And that's important to be suspicious of the beaver because he says, they say Aslan's on the move, and it makes the children all feel these different emotions, and we have no idea why because we don't know who Aslan is. I love how the fact that that's the thing that makes them start to – actually says none of the children had any except for Edmund – had any difficulty trusting the beaver now. And I think that's another thing that because Lewis has been setting up the mystery and he spent so much time setting up how we don't know who we can trust, then the fact that the children actually do trust him, they choose to trust him after he says Aslan's on the move, that's just saying something about the name of Aslan. It's setting up who is this guy and creating the sense of mystery about him. Then when they're at the Beaver's dinner table, which I think this might be my favorite scene in the whole book, the Beaver's dinner table scene. Part of it
really?
Is because...
More than Lizzie and Tumnus.
I think so. Part of it is the mouth-watering discussions of food. This is the point in this, just from a story perspective, I think it's just a very well-thought-out part of the story. It's like everything's coming together. We have what's happened, which is Tumnus, and what can we do to help Tumnus? And that's one of the things that's really, that's what's keeping the story going right now, is this tension over Lucy's kind of responsible for Tumnus being imprisoned, and what can we do to help him? And so Mr. Beaver says there's no good. He was taken to, you know, the White Witch, and you can't help him, or at least not without Aslan.
Mm-hmm.
And then, oh, and Aslan, who is this Aslan guy that this is really going to help? This is really what the next act of the story is kind of driven by, I think, is the inevitably we're going to meet this Aslan guy, and who is he? We're slowly learning more about him, and who is this guy? Oh, the idea of the prophecy. It's like it's the Council of Elrond scene of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You know, it's like here's what's happening here. Here's what we have to do. Here's the plot. And just when, and just at that moment when Mr. Beaver says, you know, if she knew there were four of you, your lives wouldn't be worth the shake of my whiskers. Then we realize that Edmund's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And we go, oh my gosh, and he's gone to the witch. And I just think that is probably my favorite plot turn, maybe out of almost any of the books. Is because he almost forgot about Edmund. He almost forgot about the Turkish delight. You're getting so wrapped up in learning about Aslan, and then, oh snap, he's gone, and he's gone to the witch, and now they have to get out of here, and it just lights a fire under the plot, and now there's a sense of urgency throughout the rest of the book, and so I just think the whole plot just jumps into the next gear with that scene, and also I love the dialogue discovering who Aslan is. So I think that's probably my favorite scene in the book.
Oh, yeah, boy, I'd have a hard time discovering my favorite scene. I don't, you know, that would be up there.
And then Edmund goes to the White Witch, and remember when we were first listening to this on CD, my brother hid under the covers, and she's like, "How dare you come alone?" And I just think I love the, I don't know, I feel like even as an adult, even though I've read the book a million times, I still kind of get chills in the anticipation over, oh, what is she gonna say that he came alone and he shouldn't have.
And one thing I love about the scene with the children, with the beavers at dinner, is even just the poetry. You know, the idea that Narnia has a history too, and Narnia has these, not just histories, but prophecies.
When Adam's flesh and Adam's bone.
Did they explain who made the prophecies? No, but that's okay.
They
just go, it's just part of the backstory that's there. Doesn't mean it's not there. Doesn't mean it's random. I think it's anything but random. It's just not explained.
One thing that a lot of people have thought about is random is, they're kind of divided on this one, but a lot of people read about Father Christmas entering the story, and remember, even Andrew Adamson himself said he had to go, when he was a kid, he actually went back and reread that part and was like, well, what's he doing there?
Yeah.
How do you feel about Father Christmas? I feel like that's one of the issues that comes up with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. How do you feel about Father Christmas?
You can talk about winter and spring without Father Christmas, but when you talk about not just winter, but a lack of joy. And not just lack of joy, but lack of warmth. And I'm not talking about a warmth like a physical warmth, but like a joy-filled warmth. The feeling of warmth you get when you're with your family by a warm fire, you know, and a, you know, cup of hot cocoa and a, you know, a good gift and a book next to you.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's that kind of feeling of warmth. Ah, see, you're smiling. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, all that has been gone from Narnia for the past 100 years.
Yeah, gone for the past 100 years. And who is the better personification of that kind of warmth and joy than Father Christmas? I think it acts as an emphasis and a rebuttal. It's a rebuttal to the witch, and it's an emphasis of all those things that come with the joy and the jovial aspects of Christmas and the spring and Aslan. They're all kind of bundled up together. I'm going to say this carefully because Lewis talked about the Christ myth. He uses the term myth in a very intentional way to kind of be provocative and get people thinking about what he meant. But if we're talking about, say, the Christ figure entering into different worlds in a different way, you know, why couldn't you have other mythical characters that different worlds know about? Why couldn't Bacchus be in both worlds?
Uh-huh.
Why couldn't Bacchus have a role in both worlds? Why couldn't Father Christmas be known somehow in both worlds?
But in one world,
he's a myth. In one world, he's part of everyday life.
I think you've hit it right there. I think Father Christmas, whatever Lewis meant to do, I think what it does for the story is, to me, it tells me this is what Narnia is. In a nutshell, in one sentence, what is Narnia? Narnia is a place where myths are real. I mean, they have fauns, they have talking animals, they have centaurs, all the things that we've heard rumors of in our world. But in Narnia, they're real. And I just think Father Christmas takes it to another level. They're like, yes, even Father Christmas, even he in Narnia is real. In addition to, of course, just obviously symbolizing the White Witch's power starting to crumble, her hold over Narnia. It isn't her. Her hold over Narnia starting to fall, and Christmas is returning. I just think it says, this is that place. And that's one I in the movie, I used to hate the line, told you he was real, because I just thought it was cheesy. And I still think it's kind of cheesy. But also, I like the idea of Lucy turning to Susan and saying, told you he was real. I think that kind of hits on something that very fundamental about Narnia.
Because without it, I mean, it's easier to just think about what without it. Because without it, it's sort of like, okay, so Aslan restored the natural change in the weather.
Uh-huh.
Big deal. You know, right. It's so much more than that, because the White Witch didn't create a situation where people said, oh, yes, now we have hot cocoa year-round, and now we have, you know, we roast chestnuts year-round, and now we have, you know, have snowball fights year-round. That's not the point. It's much more than that.
All the joy of Christmas
exactly.
is gone.
Exactly. Yeah, all the joy that comes with it. It's like all of the negatives with none of the positives.
Uh-huh.
Of winter. You know, with winter, you should have those things to look forward to in winter, and then she takes all that away. And that's one of those things that I think that it's interesting how, you know, I'm glad Gresham fought for that, even though he kind of admitted, I think, he didn't fully understand what Father Christmas did there, but he just felt it was important.
Yeah. We meet Aslan, and we still, even though we're slowly learning a lot more about him, we still feel like there's a sense of mystery and a sense of history to this guy. And then the White Witch comes along and really gives us a lot more sort of depth to Aslan's character, and starts talking about this thing called the deep magic. And this is something where I feel I would have liked more explanation. Everything we've been talking about in this podcast about you know, Lewis doesn't tell us certain things, and it gives the series more depth. Yeah, and a lot of the time that works. But this is a case where I would have liked to. I just feel like it would have made it a stronger story to know. And tell me what you think of this. To know, you know, why was the White Witch? Why does it say that all traitors belong to her, and that for every treachery, she has a right to a kill? Why is that so important to be, you know, written on the scepter of the emperor over the sea, and as deep as a spear is long, you know, all these things.
Right, right.
And even the magician's nephew doesn't really explain this. Probably even weaker, I think, is the deeper magic. The way that, you know, the deeper magic is presented, where it's just kind of and let me make sure I get the wording right here. Aslan says that though the witch knew the deep magic, there was a magic deeper still, which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time, but if she could have looked back a little further into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the table would crack and death itself would start working backward. And like, okay, so long before the dawn of time, something was written specifically for this situation. Maybe if it had been developed more, maybe I would have thought that was okay. And this is not nearly as much of a flaw as it would be in other stories, because of what a good job Lewis does setting a fairy tale tone. Lewis has already sort of set a precedent of not explaining a lot of backstory.
Right.
Why are things a certain way? Well, they just are.
Yeah, here's kind of how I see it. I see it as a twist, kind of a reveal.
Mm-hmm.
I see it as tied to the nature of the world and the characters. But I think it really gets into, okay, if Aslan is who he's supposed to be, wouldn't it make sense that he has an understanding that is nothing less than what the witch knows, but goes deeper? It just seems kind of to line up with, okay, let's say you could have a witch who is extremely powerful and is so knowledgeable about this world. Her knowledge goes back literally to when time began, but doesn't go back further.
That doesn't necessarily bother me. It's just more about how tailor-made for the situation, it seems. Like, the table would crack and death would work backwards. And I'm sort of like, well, where is the logical progression from someone being killed in a traitor's stead to death working backwards? I'm kind of missing the connection here.
You could call it, to an extent you could call it, well, tailor-made, but you could say, you know, with foreknowledge of what would happen. But I think that if I want to say if I were to say just tailor-made or contrived, it would seem, it would seem kind of fake if it were just someone stung in someone else's stead. I think that because it's Aslan, Aslan has the unique knowledge of this, and Aslan is the only one who could fulfill the role.
Yeah. And I like that. And these are all ideas I like. I like the idea that we'd find out that Aslan had knowledge from before the dawn of time. Okay, with giving us more depth to his character. I like that kind of twist. I guess I just don't like the way Lewis did it, where it was just in a way that was so incredibly tailor-made for that situation. I guess it just seems kind of convenient from a plot perspective. And there's also no possible way you can predict it. There's no kind of hint of that at all early in the story, so it kind of comes out of nowhere.
I don't know. Maybe there's an aspect where it just doesn't leave me unsatisfied. I think even just how he words it, he says, if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time, with a capital T, dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. And so I even think of it as, it's like a world of order, and there are things the children didn't understand that the witch did understand. Aslan understood things the witch didn't understand. So even in these different layers of progression of what people knew, there's something beyond even what someone like the witch can know. Uh-huh. And as far as it being tailor-made, to a certain extent, I could kind of see, I don't know, I can kind of compare it to even just, say, the cross and Christ, and, you know, oh, how convenient that, you know, if the Son of God incarnate, you know, dies for sinners. Maybe part of what frustrates you is that it's because it's Edmund alone in this situation. It's not like it's a race of people or a group of people. It is for, in this story, plot-wise, it's for Edmund by himself. Is that part of what maybe it makes it seem kind of tailor-made for you?
Maybe. I mean, it's kind of the whole world by extension, because Aslan is doing it not just to save Edmund, but to save, prevent Narnia from perishing in fire and water. It's like, in order for the deep magic to be appeased, Edmund has to be given to the witch. Edmund is now officially like a problem that has to be corrected in order for Narnia to even continue existing.
I think that's more what was promised by, you could say, the Emperor, an understanding that he is just, and if there's a traitor, there will be a punishment for the traitor. Otherwise, his good world won't continue to exist. It's almost like a promise that he wrote down himself. It's not like he's just put in a bind by some stone tablet. Mm-hmm. I see it kind of as, this is something he's written down. Why? Because he's going to insist that any traitor, that there be a punishment for any traitor. He's not going to insist that it all necessarily be the traitor who takes the punishment. So I see it kind of like that. Like that's something that, because again, it talks about, you know, being written on the Emperor's scepter and such. That's something that he is promising, and it's something that Aslan isn't going to go against, and he doesn't want to go against, because, you know, Lucy says, "Well, can't you work against it?" And he's angry at the thought that someone would want to work against.
Yeah.
These rules, these laws.
Yeah, think about Voyage of the Dawn Treader. He says, "Don't you think I'd obey my own rules?"
Yeah, I think, yeah, so the witch is saying, these are your rules, and you have to abide by them. And he's basically saying, of course, I would never go against these rules, and it makes the thought of going against them makes me angry. So I think it's a very interesting kind of juxtaposition with what the witch wants and what Aslan wants. In some ways, they kind of want the same. They're both trying to go along with the same rules. They both want the same rules to pan out, but the witch doesn't fully understand what they are.
Uh-huh.
So when I think of it, I see it as a vision, just kind of a scene, like a picture of the witch having extremely in-depth knowledge, but even that is insufficient because of just the nature of who she is. So I kind of see it as just showing kind of an emphasis on just how powerful the witch is, that how much she really does understand about the world, and that she understands more about the laws of Narnia than anyone else in Narnia, but then there's still Aslan.
I guess I wouldn't say anything that is wrong. It's one of those things where you can think it through and you can really put it under a microscope and you can say, okay, I guess I see what this is doing. But most things in Narnia, I think you don't have to do that. I think that it just, like when I'm just reading the book in the context of a story, in the context of a plot where there's things like pacing to consider, in the context of when I'm reading it, I just kind of go, wait, what? And maybe that's what Lewis wanted. Maybe he wanted you to have to think about it. And I guess Father Christmas might be another one like that. Father Christmas seems kind of weird at first. And then I look back and realize, well, I think that kind of told me something, without realizing it, that told me something about what the world of Narnia was.
You think about just, okay, what are the different topics and instances and scenes and things that come up in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? What kind of things would demand or should demand, hey, this demands deeper thought or more extensive thought to really understand.
Deeper thought from before the dawn of time.
Yeah, sorry, no pun intended. I think this would be it. It would be something along these lines. That's why I was really disappointed, because it just seemed cheap, and it really came off, I guess I'll say, as oh, how convenient, in the movie, where it was, if the witch understood the true meaning of sacrifice, and thinking, what do you mean the true meaning of sacrifice? Why does understanding the true meaning of sacrifice, what does that have to do? Does that mean that Lucy would have gotten it? You know, because maybe Lucy, being more pure of heart, would have understood the true meaning of sacrifice. I didn't really
See,
like.
I actually feel right. like, in the context of a plot, I feel like I like the movie version a little better. It just seemed like it said something about the witch's character, that she interpreted the idea of sacrifice differently than Aslan did, and therefore it was because of something to do with her character where she couldn't interpret the deep magic the same way that Aslan could, that Aslan understood it better. Because in the movie, there's no deeper magic. There's just a deep magic that they interpreted differently. And I guess you could say that Lewis has something that's more, that's a little deeper and has more, like the implications are a little more interesting. But just in the context of a plot, I think the movies works a little bit better.
See, there I'll disagree with you. It came across almost as, yes, the witch, because of how evil she is, couldn't understand it.
Because of who she is.
But the rest of us can.
No, not the rest of us, but Aslan could understand it, because he apparently understood the true meaning of sacrifice. I can see where you find that's a little bit cheesy, the true meaning of sacrifice. You know?
But I think what I like about the book is that it's a matter of only Aslan and the Emperor of the Sea, they are the only ones, just by nature of, yes, their position, but who they are, who could have ever known this. And so I like that it emphasizes even his role and even a sense of Aslan does not see himself in a competition with the witch as an equal.
Uh-huh.
I like that aspect, that his knowledge and his age even, it goes back further. Because it's not really much what do you know about Aslan Lion, Lewis, and Wardrobe? Well, he's the Emperor of the Sun of the Mountain. You don't know who the Emperor is. You don't know how old Aslan is.
Right.
You don't know about that he created Narnia.
There's a lot of good things this does for certainly the series as a whole. I'm just really saying, but when I'm reading the story, in that moment, I'm kind of like, I'm not sure if I can quite go with that. So I think it has its merit. And once again, I think for a lot of stories, this would be death, to just have something that's so convenient and so out of nowhere, that would be death. But because Lewis has set this precedent of I'm not going to explain everything, just going to explain certain things, and also such a good job he does of making this such a great fairy tale and also history, this is not the... It doesn't totally destroy it. It's kind of a mild annoyance, but it doesn't completely wreck the story because Lewis has done such a good job setting it up.
Right.
There's a moment. Let's try to wrap up here. But there's a moment after the battle, which I think people tend to forget, that I feel is just again really important for setting a mood and just saying this is what Narnia is. This is the first book, and for those who don't know, it was published in 1950. This is the first book, and later it was changed to book two. But it's the day that the kids they're walking to Cair Pereval. The kids sort of stop by the sea on their way. And, you know, they're playing in the water, and they get their feet in the sand, and Lewis writes, and oh, the cry of the seagulls, have you heard it? Can you remember? And just that sense of longing, I think, of, oh, that would be so cool, and oh, that would be so great, I think is, and Narnia is the place where all those things are real, that anytime, just like, okay, you're exploring the house, and you almost feel, what if I could find another world? What if I could go somewhere else? And I think Lewis is getting on very similar emotions here, of, oh, the cry of the seagulls, have you heard it? Can you remember? Just that sense of longing for you're not quite sure what, but of something else, of something more. I think that's such an important little moment for setting up a theme and a mood and sort of the rules for what the world of Narnia is. It's the fulfillment of something. We're not really sure what.
Well, and I think that that really ties in with a lot of Lewis's, just even his understanding on joy, which, you know, he writes about in the different writings of his, where he talks about his first experience just feeling joy,
the desire for
a little garden that his brother Warney made, and you know, he said every appetite, pretty much every appetite you can think about for a human being can be satisfied, whether it's a hunger, or whether it's a desire for human attention, or a desire for even an adrenaline rush. There's all these things that can be met and satisfied. He basically said, why would we have a yearning for this feeling of joy? That why would that, could that be unsatisfied in this world? And his only really conclusion was, well, because it
maybe
can
there, maybe
be
there is something.
But not
maybe
in
there
this
is
world.
Something more. There, maybe it can be satisfied.
We were made
somewhere.
For something more than what this world in its state right now can.
And I think Narnia, it evokes that. It evokes that, the fact that the kids find out they were made for something more. There's this prophecy, and
it's kind of a both end. It's like yes, they were made for something more. It's like, ah, yes, we feel more at home in Narnia. And they always do. They always feel more at home in Narnia than they do elsewhere. And yet at the same time, even in Narnia, there's this longing for something more. Because even Narnia doesn't meet that.
And it's not until we get to the last battle that finally they get to
further up and further
true.
In.
One of the things I think people are kind of divided on about the end of the book, and I find it so interesting. People have one or two responses. When they find out that they were in Narnia for... I can't remember exactly how long it is according to the timeline. It's something like 20 years, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
That they reign. And some people are like, oh, that's so weird. And then they read the line, if ever they remembered their life in our world, it was only as one remembers a dream. And some people go, oh, that's terrible. You know, they just totally forgot about all their friends and all their family. And how could they just totally forget and just reign for that long or whatever? And some people go, no, I wanted them to stay in Narnia and be kings and queens forever. When you first read the book, what was your response to that?
I didn't see it as... I never saw that as, oh, well, they forgot everything. I saw it as, well, they realized that they're not there anymore. And it was like, well, this is our reality now. But I remember thinking, well, even if you could never go back, I would still want to have had that. That was, I guess, what came to mind first. I wasn't thinking, oh, if only they'd been there forever. And I wasn't thinking... that's horrible. So I think I was more thinking, wow, what an amazing story. I hope they get to go back. But even if they don't, that would still be amazing. I think that was my feeling.
Like, initially it was like, oh, they're just going to stay? You know, and then I feel like when Lewis starts explaining about, you know, he was King Peter the Magnificent and Queen Susan the Gentle and King Edmund the Just and Queen Lucy the Valiant, I just kind of get caught up in the romance of that. And I just kind of go, okay, and I just kind of go with it from there on out. That's another thing, that if Lewis hadn't done such a good job setting up this fairy tale feel and wonder, I think that would have been a problem.
Yeah.
But I think in this it works. And what you're saying, of course, is the possibility that maybe they'll get back. You know, the feeling that, well, they really belong here. They belong there enough to just embrace their reign and not only think of our world as a dream. And I do think it creates that sense of longing that maybe they'll get back again, and which is a great place to leave a story, I think. All right, so
this
I think
has been
that's
fun, man.
Yeah. I don't know what this is going to get edited down to, guys. But right now we've been going for an hour and a half. And
yeah,
we'll
I'm
see
an
what
hour
we can
edit and 32 minutes
to.
Right, 33 minutes right now,
and we could go for another hour and a half, easy.
We could, you know, but that's the thing. That's why we were talking about this. We said, you know what? Okay, because Glenn, how do you want to do this? How do you want to structure? I said, you know what? We could structure it and have a 5-hour, 3-hour podcast. I say we just go with it. We'll talk about the things that come up as most important and prevalent in our minds, and we'll never stop talking about it. We'll be referencing Line the Witch and the Wardrobe as we do more podcasts. That's just the way it's going to go. But yeah, so it'll be interesting to see what it goes down to in the editing.
Obviously doing Prince Caspian next, and we'll see. I think it's going to be fun. We'll see how all this goes.
And in reference to the next 6 books, further up and further in.
Further up and further in.
What's that? Yes, of course you'll get back to Narnia again someday. Once a king in Narnia, always a king in Narnia. But don't go trying to use the same route twice.